Right, brethren, last week we concluded looking at the topic of prosperity and the believer after about, I think, 3 months or so. That didn't cover every single point, obviously, and there'll be time for other points in other time. Someone did ask me about tithing. I said, well, perhaps not right at this moment, but in a future message we'll look at that. But today we're starting a new topic. I think we're a fairly brief series, one we've done before, so we shouldn't have to belabor it too much, but it's worth a refresher because it's something that you and I do every single day. We've done it today, we'll do it later today and tomorrow and the day after and the day after, all day long. It's an area that we can become potentially very careless about because it's so common, it's so normal, it's so natural, it's just like breathing, that we don't even typically think much about it. Yet it can be a very powerful influence or force for good or bad in our lives and affect the lives of others around us. And we're talking about how we use our tongues and the power and influence of our words. So not a brand new topic, but one that, like I say, is quite important because it is something that we are doing all the day long. And if we're not paying any attention to our words, we can be digging big holes into which we can fall rather uncomfortably. And I think many people, probably in fact most people, and probably including in that most believers, have little regard for the words they use. Now, they might try, if they're believers, not to be rude to others, at least not to their face. But in the main, most people don't really think a great deal about what they're saying. Don't pay much attention to it. And yet, are words important? Or are they not? Well, let's open our Bibles to Proverbs 18:21 and read that particular verse. We have been here before. Nothing particularly new, I think, in today's some message. It'll be more of a refresher, but I think a necessary refresher. So Proverbs chapter 18 and reading verse 21. And the question we're asking is, are our words important? Does it make a difference what we say when we wag our tongues? Is that of any real relevance to anybody anywhere? Or are we just exercising a muscle in our mouth? Well, notice verse 21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. So according to the scripture, our tongues are a matter of life and death. Or it says death and life. So that's fairly important, is it not? If the power of our tongues is such that it can bring about death or life, is that not rather important? So here we are wagging our tongues all day long in conversation, sometimes talking to ourselves, talking to other people, talking on the phone, and perhaps shouting at the TV if you're upset by something you see on it. So all day long, in various different ways, we are using our tongues. And are we conscious when we do that, that according to the scripture, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it, it says, will eat its fruit. The tongue is productive. It produces something. Ultimately, it can produce death, or it can produce as its fruit life, or somewhere in between perhaps. But if you love it, it says, you'll eat its fruit. The Septuagint translation says, life and death are in the power of the tongue, and they that rule it shall eat the fruits thereof. As we'll see later on, you and I, our tongues don't control us, or at least they should not. We should be controllers of our tongues. We should decide what to say, how to say it, when to say it, to whom to say it. That's in our control. It's not a question of our tongues just running away on their own, although it often doesn't look like that to a bystander. But it says those who rule it will eat its fruits. And I would imagine if you rule it, you'd probably rule it for good rather than allowing it to run away for a bad. But nonetheless, death and life are in the power of the tongue. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 12 and read verses 36 to 37. Matthew chapter 12, see what Jesus had to say. Because I imagine we'd all agree that Jesus did know what he was talking about. He was, after all, co-designer and co-creator of human beings and birds and beasts and so on. Jesus knows how the human mind operates and also the tongue operates. And he says here in Matthew chapter 12, and beginning verse 36. So we're asking the question again, you know, are our words important? Are they particularly relevant? Does it really matter what we say or how we say it? Or do we just sort of feel something, open our words and rattle away? Is that okay? Or are our words important? Well, this proverb said life and death, and Jesus says, I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. Oops. For by your words, you will be justified. I guess if the words bring that as their fruit. And by your words, your fruit might be that you'll be condemned. So, are our words important? Well, it looks like our words will lead to being justified, set free, delivered, or the words that we use may lead us into, doesn't sound too good, does it? Condemnation. But my words? Well, I don't think my words are that important. Well, of course, that's the trouble. We often don't, but Jesus actually does. Again, he says in verse 36, I say to you, and let's face it, Jesus isn't just filling out scripture, make a bit more words in the book of Matthew, trying to get, you know, more money for it. He's saying, I'm telling you, I, the Messiah, I'm telling you that for every idle word that men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. Now, what is an idle word? Well, other translations bring out inactive or useless. Useless words, empty. Non-productive. I'm getting a whisper in my ear of futile, but words like that, useless, futile, empty, inactive, non-working, non-productive, just stupid words really. And it says you'll give account in the day of judgment, and we'll all be facing at some point in time the day of judgment. And Jesus says, because your words will justify you or they will condemn you. Now, of course, you and I live in a society with lots of TV programs, many of which are pretty useless, pretty non-productive, pretty empty, full of useless, empty, idle words. And I guess we're fairly used to that. It's part of what's around us. Lots of these TV shows, reality shows, not quite sure exactly how they work. I've not seen a reality show as yet, but I've seen headlines and comments about them. But what do you reckon about your words? I mean, if you were called to judgment today, and Jesus said, okay, John, Mary, Tom, Dick, Harry, whoever you are, we're just going to have a quick review of your words up to now. And, well, by your words that you've spoken in your life up to now, we're going to either justify you or condemn you. It won't work exactly like that, of course, but if it were, if that's what you and I were facing and our words were replayed back to us, how would you feel? Pretty comfortable? Fairly nervous? Ooh, my words. I've always been a person to speak my mind. Maybe your mind shouldn't be spoken out loud. Drop back to verse 34. Jesus says, verse 34, brood of vipers. That's strong language. I think you can accept that. talking to the Pharisees, people like that, how can you, being evil, speak good things? Talking about speaking. Because, says Jesus, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Ooh, you see, words are important on many levels. The one is that what comes out your mouth, in many, many cases, reveals what's in your heart, what's in your mind. I could look at you, for example, and not know what you're thinking or your values and so on, and you could look at me and think, well, you're a good-looking young man. Well, perhaps not. Not likely to be confused with George Clooney, I suppose. But you might think, oh, looks okay. But I'll give the game away when I start speaking, particularly under pressure. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Even there, of course, we can try and put on a show with our words for a while, but eventually, given long enough, and it starts to leak. Verse 35, a good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth the good things by what he says, and an evil man, out of the evil treasure, brings forth evil things by his speaking. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth leaks, we've often said, particularly when you're not really paying attention, or particularly when you're under pressure, and then out it pops, and it gives the game away. Now, of course, God is aware of what we're saying all day long. If he chooses to hear, I suspect sometimes he'd rather not hear. But if he does pay attention, he'll hear eventually as the day progresses, as the week progresses, as the month progresses, it will give the game away what's in our hearts. Because our hearts are very much connected to our mouths. And so, yes, our words will be part of our being justified or condemned, because our hearts will be revealed in what we say. So our words are important. They'll lead to, as Jesus says, justification or condemnation. They are a giveaway of what's in our heart, and of course death and life are in the power of the tongue. Let's look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verses 1 through 5. Psalms, Proverbs, and then Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And there's a lot in the Bible about words. And of course the Bible is made up of written words. But words, what we say to each other, what we say to God, what we even say to ourselves. It's a huge part of our lives. We're never really silent. Because if you're not talking to another person, your mind is talking to you yourself. And even there, that's quite interesting what we say to ourselves as the day progresses. You know, oh, I'm really good looking. Oh, I bet they're glad I'm in this church. Wow. Wait till I give a speech next weekend. Wow. Or very often, of course, I can't do it. I'm not able. Poor old me. Why me? And all day long we're talking to somebody. And we're talking out loud, of course, not only does God hear, if he chooses to, or anybody around us, but of course we're talking out loud, as other beings can hear. Are there not? Principalities, powers, rulers of the darkness of this world, wicked spirits, they can hear what we're saying. We've got to be careful what we say. But anyway, chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, I'm beginning in verse 1. Walk prudently when you go near to the house of God, or come to God, and draw near to hear, rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Verse 2. Do not be rash with your mouth. And let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. Now the heart and the mouth are connected. Just saw that there in Matthew. It says, don't let your heart utter, because that's how your heart's given away by what you say. But it says here, verse 2, don't be rash. You know, don't be too quick. Don't be too premature. And don't let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, you're on earth. Therefore let your words be few. You've got to be careful with your words, especially ones you're using in front of God. Jumping down to verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. For he has no pleasures in fools, a fool being one who makes a vow and fails to deliver on it. Opened the mouth, wagged the tongue, said the words, and perhaps were excited and passionate at the time, but now in the cold light of day, don't really want to do that. But, well, you said it. Said it to God. Verse 5, it is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. So we've got to be careful in front of God of all people. Say what you mean. Mean what you say. You know, verse 2 says, don't be rash with the mouth. Another translation is, do not be hasty to speak, and do not be impulsive to make a speech before God. And one translation says, don't make rash promises, and don't be hasty in bringing matters before God. Just be careful. If our words are a matter of death and life, if we be held accountable for our words, especially be careful what we say to God. We come before God in prayer. And what are we saying to God? Is it just I don't know how long a day you pray for. Maybe you're a person that prays for an hour a day. You're a rarity if you are. Maybe you manage the traditional 30 minutes a day. And maybe you're a person who struggles for 5 minutes a day. But of course, in reality, it's not exactly the time that matters. It's what happens when we're praying. But if our prayer time is no more than just a long list of complaints and murmuring and whinging, I don't know if that's an American, that translates in American, but whinging is just complaining, belly aching, poor old me. This has gone wrong, and that's gone wrong, and why did this happen to me, and why did it happen to somebody else? Well, that's not the sort of words to use before God. Don't be rash with your mouth, and don't let your heart utter anything hastily before God. And especially if you make God a commitment. Well, God, this is it. I've finally decided. You can count on me now. This will never happen again. Well, obviously, we can do that with the right intent, and weakness can come along, but just be careful. Empty promises made before God are dodgy. So it's important that you and I just think about our words from 100 different sort of perspectives. Our words are important, and being hasty is a weakness. Just because we think something doesn't mean we have to start blabbing about it, either to our family or our friends, our neighbors, or God. Some things we might want to think about for a while before we start blabbering away. The old proverb, engage the brain before emptying the mouth. Got to be careful. Our words are important. Look at Psalms 15, and we read verses 1 through 5. Psalms 15, and reading through verses 1 through 5. Can't read any more because only 5 verses, so read the whole of Psalms 15 in that case. Lord, verse 1, who may abide in your tabernacle, and who may dwell in your holy hill? Well, that's a question we'd all like to know. Well, God, Father, who can live with you? How do we get to sort of share a relationship with you? How do we get close to you? How can we sort of be a part of your family? How do we abide in your tabernacle and dwell in your holy hill? Who can do that? Who does that apply to? Answer, he who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. Speaks the truth in his heart. Speaks, heart. The heart and mouth connection again. have the abundance of their heart, their mouth speaks. This person here, the one that can dwell with God and walk with God, has a relationship with God, is a person in whose heart is truth. And of course, surprise, surprise, they speak truth. This is not somebody who deals with hypocrisy, not involved in deceit and falseness. They speak the truth in their heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, well, another use of the tongue there, backbiting. Thankfully, of course, no believer would ever backbite with their tongue. But people who do bite back, tongue like a razor, barbs on it. They think they've got me, do they? Well, I'm going to tell them a thing or two. I'm going to sort them out. Here it comes. I'm an expert in slashing and cutting. Well, that person won't be dwelling in God's holy hill. Well, according to God anyway. Nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. A reproach typically is words which are unpleasant, unhelpful, and often quite critical and rude, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. Well, that means he keeps his word. He swears to his own hurt. We made a commitment, said I'll do something or I'll not do something, and even though as time passes it's evident that not too wise that, because this is causing me a lot of trouble or a lot of expense, but no, I gave my word, and my words are important, and I'll be judged by my words. So I guess even though it's causing me some grief, well, I've said it, I better do it. And this person is one that God likes that attitude. You live by your words. You keep your word. You're a man of your word, or a woman of your word. Your words aren't idle. They aren't empty. They aren't meaningless. When you say something, you've thought about it, and you mean it. And as far as humanly you possibly can, you'll do it. Of course, there's always a few things here and there in life that sort of derail that. But we're talking about the attitude is, no, I said I'll be there at 3 o'clock on Tuesday. I will be there at 3 o'clock on Tuesday. I said I'd take that dog for a 40-mile walk. I'm taking that dog for a 40-mile walk. There might be 8 feet of snow out there. That dog's coming for 40 miles because I said it. I said I'd go and pick that person up in the car. I'm totally exhausted. It's a busy week. But I said it. I'll do it. And you can think of your own illustration, but a person whose word means something to them and means something to God. Not idle words. Not useless words. Easy to speak. And of course, in the light of day, that's going to cost me effort. And, there's a sort of a 10-hour marathon session of Gunsmoke coming to TV tomorrow I really want to catch, but here I am. I've made this commitment. What if I can wriggle out of it? I'll say I don't feel too well. I've got a bit of a sniffle coming on. Well, this person, it says, swears to his own hurt and doesn't change. I'm not backing out. I said it. It was my word. I'm doing it. That's the attitude of the person that abides in God's tabernacle and dwells in his holy hill. Verse 5, he who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent, he who does these things shall never be moved. So, be careful about our words. Obviously, if we're going to swear even to our hurt and not change, be careful what we commit to. Better to think twice or thrice before making a commitment than to make one and then think, open the mouth, got a big mouth, said something, regret it now. Well, better to engage the brain first, because when we say something, our words should be important to us, as indeed they are to God. Look at Psalms 34, verses 8 through 15. Psalms chapter 34 and verses 8 through to 15. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints. There is no want or lack to those who fear him. We read this one, I think, last week, talking about how even in difficult economic times, with the financial world tottering and possibly recessions and things, you and I shouldn't be overly concerned, because our trust, hopefully, isn't in the government or the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England. Our trust is in God, not in mammon. And it says scripturally, there is no want, no lack to those who fear God. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing. But moving on, come you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the eternal. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days, that he may see good? You know, who wants to dwell in the tabernacle of God and on his holy hill? Here's the man who desires life and wants many, many days, a long, long life, that he may see many good things. Who's that person? And how do you describe that person? What makes such a person? Verse 13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking out. The very first thing is watch your tongue. Watch out for these idle words. Watch for what you say. Engage the old brain. Verse 14, depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. If you desire life and want long days, first and foremost, guard your mouth from speaking evil and your lips from speaking guile or deceit. Yeah, the NET translation there says, do you want to really live? Would you love to live a long, happy life? Now, most would say, amen, brother, to that. What, do you want to really live? Yeah, I do. Would you love to live a long, happy life? Absolutely. It continues, then make sure you don't speak evil words or use deceptive speech. Because, remember, death and life are in the power of the tongue. And we think, well, it's just some sort of, you know, proverb. It's some sort of picturesque language. It's some sort of a meaningless platitude from the Bible. It's not really, really real. I think scripturally it's really real. When it says death and life, life and death, it means actually your words can contribute to life and death. And so it says here, if you want a long life and see many good things and enjoy what's ahead, well, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile or deceit. Depart from evil, do good, seek peace and pursue it. And verse 15, the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous and his ears are open to their cry. Because obviously we're dwelling with God in his tabernacle and on his holy hill, because we're watching our words. We recognize that our words are life and death. And all of us, I imagine, want a happy life and a long life and a good life. We want to enjoy good fruit. Well, watch what we say. And since we're saying virtually all day long, regrettably have to be on guard all day long. It's not something that you think, well, you know, once or twice a week, I'll just pay attention to what I'm saying. It's what we're saying when we're not paying attention that is the biggest hazard. And very often, you know, our minds are in one place and our tongues are in another place. And we're just wagging away and don't even recognize half the time that we're just complaining and murmuring, belly aching, saying words of jealousy, words of envy, words of bitterness, words of criticism. Usually it's negative words. Should be no reason why it shouldn't be at least equally positive and equally negative, but the human, I think, I guess, experience is such that most of the time is negative, defeatist, bad, complaining, poor old me, rather than, you know, I'm blessed. I'm God's son, I'm God's daughter, I'm looking forward to the world tomorrow. Isn't it great to know the truth? Wow, I'm better off than most folk on this earth, and saying good things. Regrettably, most of the time it's saying the bad things. Let's turn to Psalms 39 and read verses 1 through 5. Psalms 39 and reading verses 1 to 5. One of David's psalms, and he says, I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle. That's can be quite a good idea. So David says, I've got to watch out here. I've got to guard myself, lest I sin with my tongue, meaning, you know, his words, and I'll restrain my mouth with a muzzle. Just stop it from opening. Probably all seen dogs with muzzles on. If you got a muzzle on, you can't bite. If you're a dog, it stops you opening your mouth very far. And that's what David says. Restrain my mouth. Especially while the wicked are before me, because that's, I mean, usually, I guess, most of us around nice other believers, wouldn't be necessarily saying bad things, but put us in front of somebody in the world who's got an attitude and who are provocative. Now there's a test. Somebody provocative in front of you, giving you a bit of lip. Ooh. they've come to the wrong person there. They think they know how to be critical and abusive. Well, let me tell them a thing or two. Yeah, while the wicked are before you, you let rip. But David said, actually, whilst the wicked are before me, the provocative, the nasty ones, who really get up your nose, I'm going to muzzle my mouth, because that's the wrong time to be saying the wrong things. I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from saying good things. And my sorrow was stirred up. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Oh, yes, seething. Oh, angry. Ready to blurt out. Then I spoke with my tongue. But he didn't let rip to the person. He said, Lord. So he's seething, he's angry, you know, he's agitated. But he didn't shout at the person, didn't say bad words. He said, God, you better teach me to know my end. What is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am? You better teach me to have a good perspective here, God. Indeed, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my ages as nothing before you. Certainly every man of his best day is but vapor. Selah, I'll think on that. So you and I, when we're in front of this provocative person or persons, it's not an excuse for letting rip. You might be seething inside, but count to 10 or count to 110, because our words are important in our lives and the lives of others, and there's a time to restrain ourselves. Engage the brain, guard the mouth. There might be a time, of course, to speak, but just be careful. Like, very careful. And when you're seething and boiling and hot and in a rage, that probably is the last time to be telling them a thing or two about their lives and their parentage and so on. Watch out. Look at Proverbs 29 and verse 20. Proverbs 29 and just the one verse, verse 20. Do you see a man hasty in his words? Or adding there, adding to Scripture, do you see a woman hasty in her words? There's more hope for a fool than for him or her. It's a disaster area. Somebody who is quick on the lip, pow! You know, here goes that missile. Well, it says, if you're hasty in your words, you are a walking disaster area. A complete moronic idiot is better than you. So we do have to be very watchful of our words. And sometimes it says being hasty. Well, because the opposite of that is be slow. Be slow with your words. Not in the sense of speaking very slowly, but taking time. Thinking. Is this the time? Is this the person? Are these the words? Is this the tone? Is it appropriate? And sometimes the vocabulary of silence is the best response. Just say nothing. If you can't say something good, an old-fashioned proverb, say nothing at all. Just mum. Nothing. Smile sweetly and move away. Rather than being hasty, because then you're getting into potentially serious trouble. Look at Proverbs 15 and verse 4. And of course, to prevent from being hasty, you need a good mind. A heart that's connected to the tongue, and a heart that's not full of anger and the rage and the bitterness and jealousy, because if that's how our heart is, it won't take much. A little scratch, bit of friction, and bang, we're away. Telling these people a thing or two or three or four. So the abundance of the heart, that directs how the mouth speaks. Proverbs 15, should I say, in chapter 15, verse 4. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. So it says life and death, remember, or death and life in the power of the tongue. Well, here's some life here, all right. A wholesome tongue, other translations say a soothing tongue. Some say a pacifying tongue. Some translations say a healing tongue. But this is words well chosen. Not sharp, not rough, but soothing words are like a tree of life. What does a tree of life do? Well, if you could eat the tree of life, it'd live forever. So here's words that produce life. A wholesome tongue, the fruit thereof is life. Now, what do you think you and I should be famous for? Sharp, perverse, deceitful tongues? Pretty obvious what the answer is. I hope you're not going to struggle with that question. But a wholesome tongue is a tree of life. Leads to life. But perverseness in it, a perverse, a sort of corrupt tongue, a twisted tongue, you know, you sort of believe one thing but saying another, that's destructive. Breaks the spirit. I think we all come across situations, you know, where parents will say things to their children that just really are not wholesome, not upbuilding, not inspirational. You know, like, you're no good. You amount to nothing. You know, you're just like your father. Useless. Now, why can't you be like your brother or your bigger sister? These are harmful words, perverse words. I mean, some kids, of course, are quite tough and think nothing of it. Just chuckle that they managed to get up mum's nose again and run off and play. But, you know, some children are quite sensitive and they're told they're no use, never amount to anything. Why can't you be like your big brother? Some of these kids go off and that's it. The rest of their lives will be affected. Sometimes badly by the words they heard. Oh, I'm no good. I'll never amount to anything. I'll never learn. And yet wholesome words, well, you're really bright. Well, you picked it up very quickly. I think you'll be every bit as smart as your dad. Smarter, probably. It's only words. But some of those words will lead to life. And some of those words will lead to misery and disappointment and heartbreak and death. Got to be careful, because death and life and the power of the tongue and the parent, or it might be a boss at work who is hasty and says things because they're in a bad temper. Perhaps the car broke down the way to work that day and they've lost an hour and in a bad foul mood, and they just erupt at somebody innocently or who's innocent in the office, say things, and well, that person's going to be really down for the rest of the day, rest of the week, maybe the rest of their lives. Got to be careful. And whilst we're in this particular chapter, look at verses 1 through 3. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Words can bring wrath, or words can bring peace. A harsh word. You know? So, I think I mentioned before, they've done a study several decades ago, actually testing this in a purely physical sense, training people in like a call center, when they got agitated customers saying, it's not turned up or it's broken again, and the person's really jumping about and shouting and really a pretty bad mood, maybe a few swear words thrown in there, the calls were taught to actually speak very softly, a soft answer, so softly in the sense of quite a low voice. I'm really sorry to hear that. And they discovered that actually a soft voice, not just the actual words being polite and courteous, but actually a soft voice, after a while the conversation gets soft at the far end. People sort of tend to mimic a bit. They get softer and quieter, and it's hard to be angry when you're speaking softly and quietly. So even physically it seems to work. Verse 2, the tongue of the wise, that's words, is it not? Uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. Or another translation says belches. Just open that trap and out comes complete nonsense. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks, and there's nothing in there because they're idiots, fools. And it says, verse 3, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and the good. Everybody. And a wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverse in it breaks the spirit. It would seem, since verses 1, 2, and 4 are about the tongue and words, that verse 3 in context would say that God is paying some attention to what is said. I'm sure he has to close his ears from time to time. Don't think he wants to hear all the drosses out there. But God's aware of what we're all about, and the general quality of our words, because his eyes are in every place and he's watching the evil as well as the good. So we have to be a bit sort of careful. So pay attention. It is rather important. And you and I don't want to be individuals who are going to be found at the time of judgment to be using our words in a idle, non-productive, useless, critical way. let's turn to Numbers chapter 13 and read all the way through to, well, quite a bit. Numbers 13, beginning verse 30. This is a good example of what not to do with your words, because death and life is in the power of the tongue, and this is a sterling example of people going to serious trouble, like dead, as a result of using their tongues unwisely. Of course, it gave away what was in their hearts. Numbers 13:30. This is the story after Moses and Israel making their way towards the promised land the first time, and sent the spies in to see what it was like, and the spies came back with a particular story, and picking up in verse 30, Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. Good words. Positive words. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, so lots of words flying around here, And these words, it says, are called a bad report. Not a good report of the land. The land is a land flowing with milk and honey, and with pomegranates, and all sorts of goodies. But that's not what they said. They said, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. Ooh, dodgy place. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. They are big lumps. You know, broad shoulders and big thick necks and, you know, shaven heads, tattoos. There we saw the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, little midges. And so we were in their sight. And all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. This is terrible news. What? We're midgets, they're giants, the land chews you up and spins you out. Oh my word, what we're doing here. And all the children of Israel murmured, that's words by the way, against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or, here it comes, if only we had died in this wilderness. Of course, we know the rest of the story, so that really is an unfortunate thing to say. God's there. God's listening. The promised land is only a few miles away at this point. God's promised to bring them in. That's why it's called the promised land. And here they're saying, if only we had died here in this wilderness. And now we know that death and life are in the power of the tongue. Should they have said that? And aren't these words written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come? And was this not an insult to the great God, who had virtually destroyed the Egyptian empire and brought them to this point? Don't be hasty in your words. Keep your mouth of the muzzle if necessary. But they didn't. They just blabbed it out. And of course God said, that's it, Moses, get out of the way, I'm going to flatten them. And Moses said, not a great idea, God. Think of how the neighboring nations will sort of interpret that. Please pardon them. And so God said, all right then, picking up in verse 20. The Lord said, okay, I've pardoned according to your word. Words are important, and Moses' words saved their bacon. Or maybe you should call it bacon. Might be unclean. Maybe it was turkey bacon. But truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and put me to the test now these 10 times, this wasn't one off, and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. Really, really bad news this, but I mean, they said it. If only we died here. Drop it down to verse 26. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard, because you see, when we speak words, people hear, demons hear, angels hear, God hears. Got to be careful when we go before the tabernacle or temple of God. Don't be hasty with our words. I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. You'll get what you said. Got to be careful. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. Don't be hasty. Watch what you say. You may be held accountable. The carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who are numbered, according to your entire number, from 20 years old and above. Really, you know, they'd pronounced their own death sentence, hadn't they? What they believed in their heart. You know, you brought us out here to kill us. So with her mouth, it came to pass. And of course it was really unbelief that they were mouthing. They never did have any real confidence in God. They always thought he was out to get them. And they said it. And they died. All of them. Got to be careful. Don't be hasty. A better example, opposite example, you can find in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And we'll read verses 3 to 11 to begin with. 1 Samuel 17, talking of David. 1 Samuel 17. David and Goliath, this would be. Picking up in verse 3. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, Israel on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, which makes him round about sort of 10 to 12 feet tall. So now he was a big guy, genuinely. If you want to meet him in a dark night somewhere. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, which my margin says is 125 pounds weight of armor. Now, you've got to be big to carry that along, but just sort of lying there, unable to move. And he had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. That's about 15 pounds. That's on the end of your spear. You must have struggled to, you know, pick that up, let alone sort of toss it anywhere. And he's tossing it, landed about 3 feet away. I imagine he tossed it, probably went, you know, 100 yards and didn't need to actually spear you and just bounce off you and actually crushed. And a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for a battle? Because you're all a bunch of cowards. Am I not a Philistine? And you the servants of the so-called mighty Saul? Come on, choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we'll be your servants." Because he was obviously super confident. "But if I prevail against him and kill him," I have a slight advantage being twice his size and four times his weight, "then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words, they went home and started doing some embroidery. Because this guy, you don't want to tangle with. He's big, and he's mean, and he's a warrior, and there's other things happening that we can do. You know, let's bake a cake. Dropping down to verse 24, because David's now arrived, been sent down by his dad to bring some cheese sandwiches to his brothers. So he turns up, and it says in verse, where are we, 24, "And all the men of Israel, when they saw Goliath, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. And the men of Israel said to David, 'Have you seen this hombre who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter and give his father's house an exemption in Israel, tax-free.'" And David thought, "What was that again? Sorry?" David said to the men who stood by him, "What was that? What did you say would be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this scumbag Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "Well, what we just said, you know, you'll get freedom, you'll get the king's daughter, and you'll get super duper riches. It's like winning the lottery. That's what's happened if you kill this guy." And so they took him to verse 31. "When the words which David spoke were heard and reported to Saul, he sent for David. Then David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail him because of him. Your servant will go out and fight with this Philistine. I'll do it.' And Saul said to David, 'You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youngster, and he's a man of war from his youth.'" You know, he's big, you're little. But David said to Saul, No, your servant used to keep his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it, and delivered the lamb from its mouth. When it arose against me, I caught it by its beard, and struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised loser, this Philistine, will be like one of them, since he has defied the armies of the living God. So, you know, I've killed bears. I've killed lions. This guy's nothing. Moreover, David said, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So you see, back in Numbers, the people said, we're going to die here. They're like giants out there. How can we cope? How can we prosper? How can we win? Because they're giants and we're just us. And David had a different way of speaking. He said, God will deliver me from the hand of this giant. God does that for me. My trust is in God. So David's speaking words of confidence, words of life, words of gratitude. Totally different. Look at verse 43. So David goes out with a few stones in his sling, just wearing his shorts and a t-shirt. Couldn't get the armor of Saul on. He was unable to move in it. Just stood there stationary. And the Philistine said to David, am I some sort of mongrel that you can live with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. And David said, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not say with sword and spear, for the battle is the... He's here, David's words. His words are words of confidence, words of faith, words of deliverance, words of freedom, words of power. And he will give into our hands. And it was so when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hastened, not just a scarper for the horizon, but he hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. And so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. And he took out his sword and chopped his head off. End of the story. But what a difference between a man with belief in his heart, speaking words of life and faith and confidence in his God, in the face of a giant, and the other bunch facing the so-called giants in the promised land, who had no confidence, no faith, and spoke words of death and destruction. You know, God all along wanted to deliver Israel, but he needed a man or a woman who would actually step out in faith and watch their words. Look at James chapter 3, verses 1 to 2, to start with. James chapter 3. My brethren, says James, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we teachers shall receive a stricter judgment. So be careful, because you might influence many people by your words. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, a mature man, able also to bridle the whole body. If you don't stumble in your words, to stumble is to make a mistake, to err, to get it wrong. Now, if you can control your words, says James, you're a mature person. you've got it controlled. If you never stumble in your words, and of course, most of us do, some more than others, but the point is, got to control your words. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body, even a great big, you know, cart horse, right, weigh a ton, but a little tiny bit in its mouth, we pull it to the left, or the right, or say giddy up, and then yank it and it stops. Now, it's roughly, I'm not a horse person, if you know, but little thing in his mouth and he more or less does what you want. Look at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the, you know, the pilot desires. Huge vessel, little tiny thing controls it. Even so, just like that, the tongue is a little member in our body and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. It's only little, the tongue, but wow, what can it do? You know, a small spark, maybe a cigarette discarded in a forest, and you may end up with square miles of forest raging in a fire a day or two later from a little tiny, you know, cigarette end. And the same way, the tongue is very small, but wow, oh wow, the damage it can do. The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, lions and tigers and hippos and elephants and things. But no man can tame the tongue. Well, that would be no natural man. Not the same as somebody with God's Spirit, but naturally speaking, no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, uncontrolled, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. And that's why, well, that makes no sense. How could you use your mouth and your words to praise you, God? Hallelujah, God. Oh, God, I thank you. Oh, God, you're wonderful. Get away from me, you scumbag, to your neighbor. But same tongue, blessing one and cursing another, even though the man or woman next door is made in God's likeness and image and will one day hopefully be in God's family. Out of the same mouth, verse 10, proceed blessing and cursing, my brethren. This should not be. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? No. You get spring, you get one consistent water out of it. Can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine figs? No. Thus no spring can yield both salt and fresh water. So in other words, this tongue that no natural man can control, we as believers should be controlling. We should be mature. We should not be stumbling and erring in our words. We ought not definitely to be cursing people and blessing at the same time. And in this sense, cursing doesn't mean just shouting four-letter words. To curse is to say something bad about a person, because that may affect their lives, just as blessing is saying good, which might also affect their lives. We can see the way that works. If we turn to an example in Genesis 27, beginning verses 1 through 4, because what we say, our words, can produce death and life. Ancient Israel died in the wilderness. David survived his encounter with Goliath. Genesis 27, beginning in verse 1. Talking about when Isaac is an older man and wants to pass on certain benefits to his son, thinking of Esau at this stage. It came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim he could not see, because he was about 140 odd nearly at this stage, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, my son. And he said, yes, dad. He said, behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now, therefore, take your weapons, your quiver, your bow, go to the field and hunt game for me, and make me savory food, such as I love, and bring it to me, that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. Now, the words that we use can add value, can benefit a person, or they can harm a person. We think our words are of no value. That's wrong. It's not saying words properly, because our words can bless and build up, or our words can harm and tear down. Isaac knew that when he wanted to say words that would make a difference over Esau before he died. So we know that Esau raced off, get his bow and arrow, going to kill something. Meanwhile, his twin brother, Jacob, and his mother were up to a subterfuge, and we know that they dressed him up in their skins and stuff, and he was able to convince his dad that he was Esau, verse 22. So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, and he felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" And he, lying, said, "Oh, yes, I am. Me, Esau. You, Isaac." But of course he was guilty of deceit. And of course the name Jacob means supplanter. Or I suppose in our vernacular, cheat bag. And of course what you sow, you reap. He had plenty more sort of deceptions played on him in later years by Laban. He says, "Oh, bring it near me, and I will eat of my son's game so that my soul may bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate. He brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near now and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him and said. So these are, these are not just empty words. Isaac was doing something here with his words. This blessing was not just a nice thing to read of in Scripture. This was actually conveying influence and opportunity and power onto, well, he thought it was Esau, but it said Jacob. Carrying on, "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren. Let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." So that was legal. It was formal. And those words added life and prosperity and blessing to Jacob. Not empty words. They conveyed blessings. Of course, then Esau turns up, 5 minutes later. Verse 31. He also had made savory food and brought it to his father and said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that your soul may bless me." And Isaac said, "Excuse me. Who are you?" "Well, I'm your son, your firstborn." In a few minutes, Esau. Then Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, "Who? Well, where's the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I've blessed him. And indeed, he shall be blessed." He shall be blessed. It can't be withdrawn. These words were words of power. These are words that have influence. These words aren't just polite little poetry. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceeding great and bitter cry and said to him, "Bless me, even me also, my father." But he said, "Well, your brother came with deceit, and he has taken away your blessing." And we might think, well, surely Isaac could say, "Well, that was false, fraudulent. I'm going to withdraw it, cancel it." Can't. The blessing has been given. The words have been spoken. It will happen. Verse 36, and he said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing." And he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Indeed, I have made him your master, And all his brethren I've given to my servants. With grain and wine I've sustained him. What shall I do now for you, O my son? And so I think we can see here that actually one lesson we can learn is it's not easy to take back what you say. Another reason for being careful what we say. Once uttered, for good or bad, it's done. The consequences are on the way. You know, you or others are going to eat the fruit of what we all say. Don't be rash, remember, especially if we're seething. But of course, it's good in a way to know that we can bless others with our words. Now, again, we might just think, well, words are just words, they're empty. Shouldn't be. This was really happening. This was a real blessing. This was prosperity and opportunity and bounty and goodness being conveyed by the words of one man to another. Let's look at Mark chapter 10, verses 13 through 16. And I'm sure that Isaac would have liked to have withdrawn and said, oh, I think I've been diddled here. I'm going to sort of cancel it, start again. You and I might think we can do that, but you can't. Words, in some cases, you can't. You know, it's happening. Mark chapter 10, verse 13, talking of Jesus and the little children. And we'll obviously be finishing here tonight, since our time is running out, even though there's another 22 scriptures. Then they brought young children to Jesus that he might touch them. But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. Oh, get away, you people. Can't you see our master's tired? Been on it all day long. Get these brats out of here. You can more or less understand that taking place. But when Jesus saw it, he was greatly displeased. I imagine when Jesus was greatly displeased, you get a bit nervous. Oops. Got that one wrong. Jesus is greatly displeased. Oops. Start again. And he said to them, let the little children come to me. Do not forbid them. And they thought they were doing good, okay, because I guess Jesus was at times, you know, continually being sort of harried and harassed by people. You know, endless crowds are coming in and going. And they thought the last thing he wants is little kids under his feet. Go on, take those kids out of here. This is adults' business. And Jesus, getting a bit irritated by that, says, you stop that. You let little children come to me and don't forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of God. You know, little kids are innocent and teachable. Assuredly, I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it. And he took them up in his arms, put his hands on them, and blessed them. He said words over them. He spoke words of health. Well, I'm going to speculate. Obviously, none of us were there. But I'm going to say that Jesus spoke words of health and protection and prosperity and words of wisdom and understanding and a good life and so on. And that wasn't a platitude. It wasn't a question of, you know, the local newspaper report that, you know, local minister lays hands on children and speaks some empty words over them. When it says that Jesus blessed them, it means he spoke words which will have impacted all of their lives, because death and life are in the power of the tongue, and Jesus is using the power of life with these children, just as Isaac was using the power of life and prosperity and wisdom and blessing on his son, whom he thought was Esau but was Jacob. So a couple of examples there of the fact that our words are important, and you and I are using words all the time. Now, blessing is to say good things, positive things, helpful things about other people. And curses, we might cover next week briefly, are saying other things than that. Go to hell. Say that to somebody, that's not a blessing. And you are drop dead chum. Well, yeah. I was just telling me that somebody in a church wrote that to me a few years ago. Drop dead, Jamie. Well, that would not be classed as a blessing. Exactly. I suppose I close my eyes in death and instantly awaken in the resurrection, hopefully. But nonetheless, essentially that's not what you class as a blessing. So he dropped dead. And of course, trying to get the point across here, our words aren't empty and meaningless. Our words have an impact. And you need to be very careful about what we say. So we'll cover more of this next week, but I guess that's it for now. So I'd headed this particular message, beware of idle words. So I guess in conclusion, beware of idle words. Okay, brethren, with that we'll conclude today's Bible study.